Everard and band singing When I Loved You at the Brooklyn Folk Festival. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at how Amnesty International says immigrants held at the ICE jail in Florida, dubbed Alligator Alcatraz, were shackled inside a 2-foot-high metal cage and left outside without water for up to a day at a time. In a new report, they also detail unsanitary conditions, lights on 24 hours a day, poor quality food and water, and lack of privacy. The report is titled Torture and Enforced Disappearances in the Sunshine State, Human Rights Violations at Alligator Alcatraz and Chrome in Florida. We're joined now by the lead researcher, Amy Fisher, Director of Refugee and Migrant Rights at Amnesty International USA. Amy, thanks for being with us. Thanks for joining us from Bentonville. Can you describe what you found?
Sure. So myself and colleagues from Amnesty International went to Florida in September, and we were able to have a tour of the Chrome detention facility. And we were also able to speak to a number of individuals detained inside who had also been detained inside of Alligator Alcatraz. And really what we heard about both facilities were harrowing stories of human rights violations, cruel conditions, abuse, and in some cases, treatment that amounts to torture under international law.
So explain, can you describe situations you found at what the Republicans have dubbed Alligator Alcatraz?
Of course. So what we found and heard about Alligator Alcatraz is that people are housed in cages that hold about 30 people, and there's about 3 toilets per cage. The weather, the environment is very severe. And one of the things that we heard that was so concerning was the use of something called the box, which was described to us as the type of cage that you put lions in at the zoo. And people are placed in this box as a form of punishment. It is a 2-by-2-foot box where people are shackled at their wrists and at their feet and chained to the ground in the hot Florida sun for hours upon hours at a time, without food, without water, as a form of punishment. We heard that there was an incident in which somebody in one of the cages was having a medical emergency, and other people inside were calling for help for this individual, and those that were seeking help were placed in the box as a form of punishment. And after hearing about this, Amnesty made the determination that putting people in the box and the use of this box amounts to torture under international law.
So what can be done? What are you demanding, Amy Fisher?
We are calling for the shutdown of Alligator Alcatraz, as well as Chrome, as well as any other cruel detention center across the United States. What we are really seeing is an intentional development within immigration detention that is aiming to make it increasingly cruel, increasingly abusive, so that people are forced to give up their immigration claims, give up their asylum claims, because the conditions are so cruel that they can't handle it anymore. And what we know is that there are alternatives to immigration detention that are cheaper, that respect human rights, and actually lift up all communities. And so what we need to do is shut down these facilities and instead invest in an immigration system that works for all of us.
I wanted to go to a vigil outside of Alligator Alcatraz. Sonia Bechara spoke about the conditions that her fiancé, Rafael Collado, faced inside the jail.
He has been there for a month and 3 days, and he has told me that the conditions inside are deplorable. The food is terrible. They keep the lights on all the time to keep them awake. They say they are tired of seeing each other's faces. They are given 5 minutes to eat and only a small cup of water with their meal. If they stand up, they're beaten. They turn the identifications around so they can't see the names. Some tell them the time. Others don't, because they don't know what time it is. They only know when they call home. My fiancé asks me what time it is, what day it is today, and it breaks my heart when he asks me that question.
In response to the amnesty report, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida issued a statement that read, quote, "This report is nothing more than a politically motivated attack. None of these fabrications are true. In fact, running these allegations without any evidence whatsoever could jeopardize the safety and security of our staff and those being housed at Alligator Alcatraz." Amy Fisher, your response.
First of all, if the governor would like to see some evidence, I encourage him and his office to read the report where that evidence is presented. But more than anything, if Governor DeSantis is really concerned about the care and safety of those in custody, then he should shut down Alligator Alcatraz and allow these people to return to their communities where they belong.
Amy Fisher, I want to thank you so much for being with us and ask one last question about Chrome. I remember years ago when people were marching on Chrome because of Haitians who were fleeing violence in Haiti were being placed there and the conditions that they faced. If you can briefly summarize what you found there.
What we found at Chrome was very similar to what other people have been reporting for years, horrific conditions. You know, one of the things that most impacted me at the time in Chrome is that we were speaking to somebody in solitary confinement who was showing us an injured hand through the slot on the door, and an ICE agent slammed a metal flap of the solitary confinement door on this man's injured hand and then punched it repeatedly. And that was such a show of force, a show of violence, and it happened in front of human rights monitors. And so we know the conditions are horrible. And when we see that type of activity in front of human rights monitors, we can only imagine the type of cruelty that is going on a day-to-day basis behind closed doors.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Amy. Amy Fisher, lead researcher on the new Amnesty International report, Torture and Enforced Disappearances in the Sunshine State. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us from Bentonville, Arkansas. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to two shocking immigration cases among many. In a minute, we'll look at what happened to a 19-year-old Babson College freshman arrested at the Boston airport and deported to Honduras last month when she was flying, hoping to fly in a surprise visit to her family in Texas for Thanksgiving. But first, we turn to the case of Bruna Caroline Ferreira, the mother of the 11-year-old nephew of White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt. Ferreira shares a child with Levitt's brother, Michael Levitt. She's a Brazilian immigrant who arrived to the U.S. when she was 6 years old. New video of her arrest has just been obtained and released by TMZ. She was stopped on November 12th. She had left her son off at school. On Tuesday, Bruna Ferreira was released from detention in Louisiana on a $1,500 bond. The Trump administration's characterized her as a criminal illegal alien from Brazil, a characterization Bruna refutes and is called disgusting. For more, we're joined by her attorney, Todd Pomerleau, in Norwell, Massachusetts. Thanks so much for being with us, Todd. Explain what happened in court yesterday. Tell us Bruna's story, why she was detained, and now the government did not challenge her release.
Yes, thank you so much for having me, and it's a real privilege to come here today and discuss yet another abuse of immigration and custom enforcement's cruel immigration policies. Bruna Ferreira is a mother of Michael Jr., an 11-year-old, and she was surreptitiously arrested, and the government was trying to deport a person who's been trying to get a green card since the age of 18 years old, and they have falsely claimed that she is a quote-unquote criminal illegal alien, which they claim about all of the clients we've had that have been unlawfully arrested and detained. She had a bond hearing at 10 a.m. Monday in the immigration court in Oakdale, Louisiana, 1,500 miles away from her home, away from her child, away from her business. And during the argument, Jason Thomas, former DHS counsel, he's a managing attorney with our office in Boston. He basically laid out chapter and verse why that was a bold and wrong characterization of Bruna Ferreira. She has zero criminal record. She's been trying to get a green card since the age of 18. They said she illegally entered the country, yet she came here at the age of 6 on a tourist visa, which is a lawful entry. Her grandmother brought her here. When her grandmother was going to bring her back home, her grandmother passed away unexpectedly in Brazil, so she had no way back. They expect a six-year-old child, apparently, to pack her bags and buy a plane ticket and fly back to Brazil. And then on top of that, they've been falsely claiming she was arrested. She's never been arrested in her life except for the rogue unlawful arrest that occurred on November the 12th. We talked about how she never was convicted or even accused of a crime. This is a juvenile offense when she was 16 years old. It's subject to privacy laws under Massachusetts. Her and another girl in high school were seen pushing each other in the parking lot of a Dunkin' Donuts where they were arguing over who was entitled to the $8 of change from a purchase. And a police officer just happened to be driving by, and he told them each to go to the juvenile court where they were summoned, not arrested, not for a crime, and the case was promptly dismissed. So they've been engaging in character assassination against her. When we made all of these arguments, when DHS had its turn, its lawyer said two words, I stipulate. That means it agreed factually and legally to every single argument we made. The judge set the minimum bond available, $1,500, which is what we asked for, and the government then said it waived appeal.
I wanted to ask you, I mean, this is the mother of the nephew of Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press spokesperson. What has she said about this? Bruna was involved for years and had the baby with Michael, Carolyn Leavitt's brother. She also suggested, why would they even know where she was driving? The only people who knew, because she was driving her kid to and from school, Michael Jr., was Michael, Carolyn's brother. What is going on here, and what has Carolyn Leavitt said, the White House press spokesperson, who so often reiterates Trump's anti-immigrant policies?
For somebody who has a lot of rhetoric and a lot to say about non-citizens throughout the United States, she hasn't said anything about this case. The DHS press secretary is the one that keeps falsely claiming, libelously and slanderously, by the way, that Bruna is a criminal legal alien, keeps regurgitating that she was arrested for a crime, which is factually and legally false. And then even after its own lawyer agreed that that was, that it stipulated that that wasn't true, it still continues with that character assassination. Caroline Leavitt would have been my client's sister-in-law had she married Michael Sr. They were madly in love when they were young. They were engaged to be married. They had a child, and like a lot of relationships in the world, it broke up. She's never harbored any animosity toward the Leavitt family. She has spoken very kindly of Caroline. She even picked Caroline to be the mother-in-law, I mean, to be the godmother, excuse me, for Michael Jr. over her own sister. She has one sister, and she chose Caroline Leavitt to be the godmother. And that's a significant thing for Catholics in America to do. And she's just dumbfounded. She was sitting in a for-profit prison in Louisiana. This is a single mother who owns two businesses. She actually looked up to Caroline because Caroline is a woman who rose to a position of power. She ran for Congress at a young age. She's now the press secretary, which is an envious position for anyone to be in. And she's always looked kindly upon her. But Caroline was a high schooler when she was dating Michael. Caroline's 6 or 7 years younger than Bruna. Bruna's 32 years old. So she's just absolutely astounded the way she's been labeled. I mean, if she's a criminal illegal alien now, which they keep calling her, she was a criminal illegal alien then when she was dating Michael, when she was engaged to him, and when she was at a baseball game with Michael Jr. where Caroline was a couple spring times ago. So all of a sudden now the Leavitts have a problem with criminal illegal aliens, yet one of them was about to marry one of their loved ones, and there was no problem then.
And so now she's out. She was sent to Louisiana. She was jailed. What happens next?
It was even worse than that. She was arrested in her driveway. They knew exactly where she was going to be. She was driving a car not registered to her. Five federal agents with masks over their faces just barricaded her in her driveway when she was pulling out onto the street to go pick up her son 33 miles away from her house like she did 4 or 5 days a week. And they never showed her a warrant. At first, they asked her for her license, and she thought it was odd because it didn't appear to be a traffic stop. She's not clueless. She watches the news, and ICE wears masks all over their faces because they don't want to apparently show the public who they are. And then she was asked if she was Bruna, and she was puzzled, and she said, why are you asking me my name? And then they arrested her, and she demanded to see a warrant, and they never saw one. TMZ leaked the video that I had never seen about a week ago, and it shows a brazen, unconstitutional arrest, a clear violation of her rights, and it's just really uncalled for. At first, we thought it was happenstance, because it wouldn't surprise me if ICE would actually arrest Melania Trump. They just go around and arrest everybody these days, with apparently no recourse, according to their own policies. But again, we're in courtrooms. The first chance we had, she was released on $1,500 bail. Bruna is a fighter. She's a strong, courageous woman, And she had one of her days in court, and she'll have many more in the future where we expect her to get her lawful permanent residency. There is no reason under the law for even arresting her. She wasn't dangerous. She wasn't a risk of flight, according to the government's own lawyer. And that's the standard that was required to actually arrest her again when she's in the middle of a green card process.
Mm. Well, Attorney Todd Bomerlo, we have one last question to ask you about another of your clients, Ana Lucia Lopez-Beloza, this 19-year-old Babson College freshman arrested last month at Boston Airport when she was at the gate as she was going to surprise her family for Thanksgiving in Texas, but she was deported to Honduras. She spoke to MS Now about how her lawyers tried to stop the deportation to no avail.
Hours passed and even the night passed, and in the morning, that's where I found out that I was gone. That they were going to transfer me to Texas. And I was like, can we call my family so I can let them know? They didn't allow me to. So I didn't even know that I had, that my lawyer had put it orders so I wouldn't be able to, so I couldn't move me to Texas. And it hurt me because I wasn't able to let them know that I was going to get deported. And I didn't even know that I was going to get deported until I was on the plane.
So, Attorney Todd Bomerlo, the Trump administration says your client missed multiple opportunities to fight a removal order. But she came to the U.S. as a 7-year-old asylum seeker. DHS spokeswoman McLaughlin said she received full due process, but she was unaware of her prior removal order. Is that right? Before being detained? And what did the judge say about not deporting her?
Yeah, this is yet another character assassination. They are labeling a child still under the immigration law, under the age of 21, you're considered a child. She came around was actually 8 years old. She came here with a mother fleeing persecution in Honduras, seeking asylum. That's a lawful process, and yet they call her illegal again. She was legally pursuing asylum. Their lawyer explained to the mom and to Ani that she had no deportation and nothing to worry about. I got the case very late Thursday night. It was the day she was arrested. She was arrested early that morning. I got it around 10:30 that night and was looking into it. At first, I thought she was flying into the United States as a college student, possibly on an F-1 visa. And we learned the opposite. She was traveling domestically, not internationally. This is the first arrest of its kind I've seen. And I've done over 75 of these habeas cases in the last 6 months. Friday, we were trying to reach out to the ICE field office to no avail. She was in a database, showed as being in their custody. And then right around the time we started contacting them, they deleted her from the database, treating her like she wasn't in the custody at all of the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office. We filed the lawsuit at 6 o'clock at night. At 6:08, a federal judge issued an order preventing her deportation from the country, requiring her to have a court hearing. And then we talked to her father, and he thought she was deported on Friday, and he was crying. And then we reconnected with him on Monday. He told us, yes, Ani was deported on Saturday from Texas, is what he told us. And I almost fell out of my chair. This is a clear violation of a federal court order. She was not supposed to be removed from the country. She was supposed to be brought to court for her hearing, where we were challenging her detention as being unlawful under the Constitution and the statutes and regulations of the United States. She had no idea she had a removal order. She should have been given the courtesy of talking to a lawyer, not having our office ignored, which is a repeat theme with ICE. They don't answer their phone anymore. They don't respond to emails, but they manage to have the time and capacity and money to arrest people 24/7. It's really unconscionable and cruel what they did to a child. And we have a hearing coming up soon in the federal court. This is contemptuous conduct. The government responded last week. I thought it might have said sorry, or maybe they didn't know about the court order. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. And it is doubling down. And its claim is basically that she got what she wanted. She's not in unlawful custody anymore. So basically, boo-hoo, stop complaining. And by the way, they're telling the judge that it ignored the judge's order because it didn't think the judge had the authority to issue it. That's not the rule of law.
So, Todd Bomerlo, in 30 seconds, what's happening to her family right now in Texas?
Her family is being targeted now, apparently, for speaking out to the press about the unlawful and unconstitutional violation of their daughter's rights. Apparently, on Sunday, they were trying to break into the backyard of the dad's and mom's home without a warrant and tried chasing the dad into his house when he was washing his car with his 2-year-old U.S. citizen toddler. This is just beyond the pale what we were seeing on a daily basis, and the public needs to know what is going on. They are not arresting criminal illegal aliens, even though they are labeling them as such. They are attacking hardworking people, And if we want to have their whole goal is mass deportation now, with that, you're not going to have democracy now. What we require is mass deportation defense.
And she was shackled and handcuffed when she was deported?
That is correct. They not only did they arrest her at the airport and handcuff her and put her in a van, bring her to an ICE facility, and then put her at a military base and hide her from the public and from her lawyer. The day she was deported in Texas, she said she was taken down near the border on a bus, had shackles around her ankles, around her chain around her waist, and shackles around her wrist. And she was treated like she was going on a perp walk, like she was some type of sexual predator or hardened criminal. And then she was flown on a plane to Honduras, wasn't allowed to make a phone call once on Friday or Saturday, and she had to find her grandparents, who she hasn't seen in 12 years, once she got off the tarmac in Honduras.
Todd Pomerleau, I want to thank you for being with us, the attorney representing Ani Lucia Lopez-Beloza, a Babson College freshman, deported, defying a judge's order for her not to be sent out of the country. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll follow these stories. Next up, the Montgomery bus boycott started 70 years ago. What is the lesson of Rosa Parks sitting down on that bus? Was she just tired? Or did she lead a life of activism that led to the desegregation of the transportation system of Alabama? Back in 20 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to look at lessons from the Montgomery bus boycott, which started 70 years ago this month, December 5th, 1955, after the civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks was arrested days earlier for violating segregation laws when she refused to give up her seat on a city bus to a white man. The year-long boycott would help spark the civil rights movement. This is Rosa Parks speaking to Pacifica Radio in April of 1956, in the midst of the bus boycott.
The driver said that if I refused to leave the seat, he would have to call the police, and I told him, just call the police. He then called the officers of the law. They came and placed me under arrest. Violation of the segregation law of the city and state of Alabama and transportation. I didn't think I was violating any. I felt that I was not being treated right, then that I had a right to retain the seat that I had taken as a passenger on the bus. The time had just come when I had been pushed as far as I could stand to be pushed, I suppose. They placed me under arrest.
Rosa Parks in a Pacifica Radio interview in 1956. For more, we're joined by the historian Jean Theo Harris, professor of political science at Brooklyn College, author of 13 books on the civil rights movement, including The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Also, there's a young adult version of the book and a documentary by the same name. You just wrote a piece in The Guardian, Professor Theo Harris, headlined What We Get Wrong About the Montgomery Bus Boycott and What We Can Learn from It. Teach.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. So I think the ways that we now remember and honor the Montgomery bus boycott is that it was the right action with the right person, and it was sort of destined to succeed. And that in the United States, if you have the right action, right, injustice is vanquished. And that is a comfortable story, but it's not an accurate story. All right, let's start with Rosa Parks. As you just mentioned, she is a longtime activist by this point. She's been active for about 20 years. In fact, this is not going to be her first bus stand. She had been thrown off the bus by this very bus driver and other bus drivers because she refused the practice. Some bus drivers would make black people pay in the front but have to get off and reboard in the back. She refused to do that, had been thrown off by this bus driver 12 years earlier, and by other bus drivers for being uppity. This is also not the first time somebody's going to be arrested for refusing to give up their seat. In fact, in 1944, a woman by the name of Viola White refuses to give up her seat on the bus. She decides to pursue her legal case, and in response, the police rape her daughter. And then the state holds up her appeal for so long that Mrs. White actually dies before her appeal ever goes to court. And this is, they will learn from this, because Rosa Parks and Edie Nixon, who are longtime, who will become the kind of two leaders of Montgomery's NAACP in 1945, and for the next decade, helped to transform it into a more activist branch. They learn from Viola White. There's a trickle of cases over that decade. A neighbor of Rosa Parks refuses to get off and reboard. He's killed on the bus by police. And then, as many of us know, in March of 1955, Claudette Colvin, 15-year-old Claudette Colvin, refuses to give up her seat on the bus. As the police take her from the bus, they manhandle her. Colvin, you know, resists their having their hands all over her. And so police don't only arrest Colvin on a segregation charge, but they arrest her on an assaulting an officer charge. Colvin is this very petite 15-year-old, and on a disturbing the peace charge. Montgomery is outraged. Black Montgomery is outraged. Rosa Parks starts fundraising for Colvin's case. And then a couple things happen. The judge strategically throws out the segregation charge. He only convicts Colvin on an assault charge. So that's the first issue that's going to make this case hard to pursue.
Wait,
but
2 minutes.
The second is that Colvin is a teenager, and many adults don't trust a teenager. So let's fast forward. Now we're at December 1st, 1955. There is nothing to suggest. What makes what Rosa Parks does so courageous is there is nothing to suggest that making a stand on this day will do anything. And I think that's one of the biggest myths. Right? And one of the biggest misunderstandings of her courage, part of what her courage is the ability to step forward again and again without any sense that this is going to change anything and say, this is the line and I refuse.
I mean, so interesting. She had worked for years fighting against and exposing the rapes of black women. She was deeply moved and horrified by the lynching and killing of Emmett Till. But as you said, she didn't know if this would have an effect, but she sat down on that bus. Then there was Joanne Robinson. Talk about that. A few days later, the bus boycott is launched. And she, in fact, Rosa Parks, launches Dr. Martin Luther King, a young pastor who just moved to town.
Right. So she's bailed out a few hours later.
When 1 minute.
Edie Nixon sees that she is okay, because that she hasn't been physically hurt, he's delighted. This could be a possible test case. She and her husband have to think. That night, she decides she will go forward. She calls a young black lawyer named Fred Gray. That night, Fred Gray calls Joanne Robinson. Joanne Robinson's the head of the Women's Political Council. They have a plan. In the middle of the night, Robinson sneaks into Alabama State, where she works, and with the help of two students, runs off 35,000 leaflets. And the next morning, the women of the Women's Political Council fan out over Montgomery with those leaflets. They're originally calling for a one-day boycott.
But it ends up being a year, and 1 year later, the final result.
The buses are desegregated. It's not about walking. They organize this incredible carpool system. They set up 40 pickup stations all around the city. They're giving, at its peak, 15,000 to 20,000 rides a day. All of this, right, exceeds every time people take a step. They, again, what is imagined gets broader. And they turn it from a one-day to a year-long boycott from first come, first serve.
That's the story of Rosa Parks. To go to all our interviews with Jean Theo Harris on the rebellious life of Rosa Parks, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
For many, a career in music is a dream come true. However, the reality is that many people in the Canadian music industry do not have access to medical benefits and financial aid. This is especially true for our music industry veterans, and it's why the Unison Fund created the Slate Family Foundation Legacy Program. To learn more on how you can support legacy artists and musicians who are coping with unexpected or chronic illness, visit unisonfund.ca.